You're listening to Radio Maria, a Christian voice in your home. We now bring you Salvation is from the Jews with Roy Shoman.
Hi, this is Roy Shoman, and welcome once again to Salvation is from the Jews, the show on Radio Maria that celebrates the Jewish roots of the Catholic faith, or seen the other way around, that celebrates the fulfillment, the completion, the full realization of the promise of Judaism in the Catholic Church and its sacraments. And before I begin the show proper, let me remind you that if you wish to listen to any past shows, they are all, the last few months are all archived on the Radio Maria website, which is radiomaria.us. And the shows all the way back to the beginnings of the series about two plus years ago are archived on my website, salvationisfromthejews.com. That's salvation is from the Jews, all one word, .com. And in fact, all other things are on my website too, of course, including my upcoming speaking engagements, pilgrimage that I will be leading to the Holy Land next spring, a kind of a Jewish roots of the Catholic faith pilgrimage, all of the normal Catholic sites, but also a number of sites, basically sanctified by the Old Testament and by the patriarchs and prophets in the Old Testament and so forth. It'll be, I think, quite a unique spiritual experience. And the information on that pilgrimage is also up there on my website, should any of our listeners perhaps be interested. We'll, in fact, be leaving on Divine Mercy Sunday, April 3rd of 2016, for about 12 or 13 days in the Holy Land. So you can find out about that on my website also. The my plan for today's show is a little bit different. I do not have a guest lined up. I hope to next week have another Jewish Catholic convert, so to speak, on the show to give his witness testimony. But I don't today, and what I'd like to do today is talk about a very interesting kind of spiritual phenomenon in God's economy of salvation for mankind, which is the concept of the faithful remnant. And to do so, I will be reading some passages from my first book, Salvation is from the Jews, which deals, actually it's the subtitle is The Role of Judaism in Salvation History from Abraham to the Second Coming. It deals with God's overall plan for salvation history, actually from the creation of the world until the Second Coming, and the interplay between the first his revelation to the Jews through Judaism, and then the full revelation of his role with humanity through Jesus and Christianity and the interaction between the two. So let me begin reading about the faithful remnants from my book, and I will interrupt myself with comments. And I think you'll find this exploration quite interesting and extremely relevant to the mystery of the role of Jews and Judaism in between the first and second coming of Christ, and even their role in the second coming of Christ. So here goes. Faithful remnants in the scriptures. The story of the Jews' behavior when the Messiah did come is not, of course, a happy one, and it is easy to jump to the conclusion that the Jews failed in the task for which they were chosen. Yet such is not, in fact, the case. Throughout sacred scriptures, we see the same pattern repeating itself over and over again. God works through small numbers, so-called faithful remnants, who are almost invisible within a larger sea of largely unfaithful humanity. The first time we see this is in the story of Noah. God was disgusted with mankind and determined to make an end to the experiment and blot mankind off the face of the earth. But the presence of a single man, Noah, who was pleasing in God's sight, was enough to cause him to relent and to spare the race through his descendants. And then the passage goes on to recite the passage from Genesis chapter 6 and chapter 7, where I'll just skip through it briefly. God saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart were only evil continually. And the Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him to his heart. So the Lord said, I will blot out man whom I have created from the face of the ground, for I am sorry that I have made them. But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord, and God said to Noah, I have determined to make an end of all flesh, for the earth is filled with violence through them. I will destroy them with the earth, but make yourself an ark, for behold, I will bring a flood of waters upon the earth to destroy all flesh, but I will establish my covenant with you, and you shall come into the ark, you, your sons, your wife, and your sons' wives with you. Noah did this. He did all that God commanded him. Then the Lord said to Noah, go into the ark, you and all your household, for I have seen that you are righteous before me in this generation. And Noah and his sons and his wife and his sons' wives with him went into the ark to escape the waters of the flood. End of citation from Genesis chapter 6 and 7. Here we see the human race itself preserved because one man was pleasing in the sight of God. This pattern is repeated a bit later in human history with the story of Sodom and Gomorrah. The wickedness of those cities was so great that God determined that in justice he was compelled to destroy them. Yet, through the pleading of Abraham, he agreed that the cities would be spared if just 10 just men could be found in them. You'll find that described in Genesis chapter 18, verses 20 to 29. So Abraham gradually negotiated God down to the point where God conceded, for the sake of 10 righteous men that I find in Sodom and Gomorrah, I will not destroy it. Unfortunately, he was unable to find 10 righteous men. This basic pattern of an entire people being saved for the sake of a tiny faithful remnant is a constantly recurring theme throughout the Old Testament. And then I go into a number of different examples of this in the Old Testament, where, for instance, the situation in which God spared all of the Jews actually fleeing Egypt during the Exodus for the sake of Moses. That's in Exodus chapter 32. The case where there was a drought over the entire land of Israel, and God lifted that drought and spared the land of Israel for the sake of Elijah, which is recounted in 1 Kings chapter 18. This is the context in which we must see the betrayal of Jesus by the Jews. Yes, the crowd shouted, crucify him. Yes, the crowd uttered that horrible self-imprecation, his blood be on us and on our children. The masses betrayed Jesus. The masses were fickle and evil-hearted. However, there was a faithful remnant of Jews who were worthy of the calling for which they were chosen, a remnant that included, first and foremost, the Blessed Virgin Mary and Joseph and Elizabeth and Zechariah and John the Baptist and the apostles, with one unfortunate exception, and the first martyr Stephen and the other disciples. This seems to be the way that God works, and in fact, all that God in the long run realistically expects from any people, even, unfortunately, the church. Even the church, made up of Catholics who have the inconceivable graces that come from the sacraments, who have the fullness of the truth taught through the magisterium, who have the example, inspiration, and intercession of all the saints, even among them, unfortunately, there may be only a faithful remnant that remains pleasing to God. For did not our Lord say, enter by the narrow gate, for the gate is wide and the way is easy that leads to destruction, and those who enter by it are many. But the gate is narrow and the way is hard that leads to life, and those who find it are few. Matthew 7:13-14. And the final proof, of course, that the Jews did in fact succeed in their mission is the fact that the incarnation and subsequent evangelization through them did succeed. So my point here is that even though superficially it may look like the Jews failed in their fundamental mission, because when Jesus came, most of them didn't recognize him. First of all, they did succeed by definition in their fundamental mission, because Jesus did come and all of humanity was offered salvation through Jesus and through the gospel being preached to the four corners of the earth, which was also affected initially by the Jews. So there could hardly be 2+ billion Christians in the world if the Jews had failed in their task. Obviously, they by definition must have succeeded. And to the point that the majority of them rejected Jesus, one of the points I'm making here is that throughout salvation history, both in the Old Testament and in the New Testament and in the stories of the saints, even over the last 2,000 years since the New Testament, you see the same pattern, that by and large, the mass of humanity is unfaithful to God, the mass of humanity fails him, but God spares all of humanity for the sake of the few who are genuinely pleasing to him. And that's the concept of faithful remnants that I am addressing in this passage. So going back to this chapter on faithful remnants from my book, Salvation is from the Jews, let me continue. In both Judaism and Christianity, the teaching and revelations about the role of faithful remnants has continued. Talmudic Judaism teaches that the continued existence of the entire world is being supported by the prayers of 36 righteous men. This same principle that for the sake of just a few faithful souls, entire countries or even the entire world are spared divine justice is frequently reflected in private revelations made to Christian saints. The most dramatic private revelations of the last century were those of Fatima, in which first the angel of Portugal and then the Blessed Virgin Mary herself appeared to three young shepherd children in a remote village of Portugal during 1916 and 1917. At his first appearance, the angel of Portugal exhorted the children to pray. When he appeared again a few months later, he found them playing, and he reproved them, saying, "What are you doing?" he asked. "Pray, pray very much. The hearts of Jesus and Mary have designs of mercy on you. Offer prayers and sacrifices constantly to the Most High. You will thus draw down peace upon your country." Very mysterious and very powerful, right? Because here we see that the prayers and sacrifices of three young, ignorant peasant children were, to a large part, responsible for delivering the entire country of Portugal from the horrors of World War I. Another similar example is provided by the revelations made to the recently canonized Saint Faustina, in which Jesus revealed that as a result of her prayers, Poland would be spared total destruction during World War II. Some of Jesus' words to her about the power of her intercession include the following. For instance, "For your sake, I will bless the entire country." Another time, Jesus said to her, "My daughter, your confidence and love restrain my justice, and I cannot inflict punishment because you hinder me from doing so." Another time, he said to her, "Let me tell you that there are but a few souls living in the world who love me dearly. They are a defense for the world before the justice of the Heavenly Father and a means of obtaining mercy for the world. The love and sacrifice of these souls sustain the world in existence." Here we see very much the same concept as I earlier cited from the Talmud, that the prayers and faithfulness of 36 righteous men are what sustain all of mankind in the favor of God, that what sustain the whole world. And here we see Jesus telling Saint Faustina that but a few souls living in the world who love him dearly, and the love and sacrifice of these souls sustain the world in existence. In fact, it's exactly the same concept. Let me interject here for a moment. I don't know how many people I'm speaking to. I'm sure I'm speaking to at least a few thousand, maybe many times more than that. You know, we are, I mean, I'm one of whatever it is, 6 billion people in the world. Each one of you is one of 6 billion people in the world. The world is in a terrible shape. Every week we see things getting worse and worse in our country, in the morality, in our laws, in the behavior of the government, in the everything, in the pornography and in the irreverence and in the blasphemy that is, you know, spreading throughout, you know, our culture and our country and our civilization. And it might be tempting to, you know, throw up our hands and say, "What can I do?" It's like, you know, we know the story of the little boy in Holland with his thumb in the dike, but this is like a little boy trying to stop with his thumb, you know, a tsunami. But here we have the rebuttal to that. Here we have the truth of the matter, which is each one of us, if we are truly pleasing to God, if we align ourselves more and more completely with the will of God, if we dedicate ourselves to holiness and justice and prayer, we can have an immeasurable effect on the fate of the world. Really? That's the evidence given by, you know, the Old Testament, by the New Testament, by Jesus' words, the saints that I'm reading, and so forth and so on. And, you know, if you are in a nursing home, or if you are in a hospital bed, or if you are, you know, abandoned in an apartment with nobody visiting you, or whatever the situation is, in fact, the more that you're suffering and the more that you're abandoned, in some sense, the more potential power your prayers have. Because your suffering united with your prayers, your offering of that suffering united with your prayers, makes them ever more powerful. You know, if the world has a chance, that chance lies in the prayers and sacrifices of the few faithful remnants, so to speak, of those few people who are still in tune with the will of God, who know the truths of Christianity, and in particular the truth of the Catholic faith, who have the strength and the enhanced intimacy with God, which comes through the sacraments of the Catholic faith. So use that and do not minimize or despair of the influence or effectiveness or importance of what you're doing. And of course, the world doesn't just have God on one side, it also has the devil on the other side. And the last thing the devil wants is the fidelity of the faithful remnant and the heartfelt prayers of the faithful remnant and the dedication of the faithful remnant and so forth, because that's the one thing left that's constraining his power and his influence over the world. So that voice in your head, which may say, what difference does it make? You know, the world's going to hell in a handbasket, or what difference does it make? You know, nobody knows I'm here and nobody hears my prayers. Those voices are probably coming from the devil, precisely because your prayers and what you're doing and your reaching out to God for mercy on the world are so infinitely important, and therefore so infinitely destructive to the devil and his agenda. So I will go back now to reading quotes from what Jesus said to St. Faustina. These are all from her diary. When I finish the quotes, I'll tell you what paragraphs there are in her diary. I can't recommend her diary too strongly for spiritual reading. For your sake, I will withhold the hand which punishes. For your sake, I will bless the earth. So here Jesus is saying, for the sake of this one hidden nobody, none in a convent in Poland, he will bless the whole earth and withhold the hand which punishes. Another time he said to St. Faustina, by your entreaties, you and your companions shall obtain mercy for yourselves and for the world. And again he said to her, through your prayers, you shall mediate between heaven and earth. So just the same thing over and over again. It's not a matter of numbers. This is not a democratic system where if, you know, 51% of humanity are on the side of God, God wins. And if, you know, 49% are on the side of God and 51% are on the side of the devil wins. That's not how this works. You know, Jesus single-handedly, that's a little bit unfair because, of course, he was God, defeated the power of Satan. The three children of Portugal, the three children of Fatima spared Portugal from the worst of the ravages of World War II. The prayers of this one nun, St. Faustina, spared Poland a total destruction during World War II. It's not a matter of numbers. It's not a, you know, democracy where every vote counts equally. There's an almost infinite power. There's certainly an untold and inconceivable power to the prayers of a single person who is really, there are lots of terminology for it. I don't know the right terminology. Whose will is aligned with the will of God, whose heart is, who loves God with their whole heart and mind and soul, however you want to think of it. If you do that, if you really give yourself to God and take God in and basically prefer God's will to your will and try to align yourself with God's will, your prayers have infinite power. Back to reading, so I don't just say the same thing over and over again. Let me interrupt myself, though, and say this is a live show. This is a call-in show. So if you have any comments or questions or want to join the monologue, I can't call it a discussion since I'm alone, the number here is 866-333-6279. So back to this section about the faithful remnant. The testimony about how God works with mankind is clear, both from Judaism and Christianity. The relationship between God and mankind is not established and maintained on the basis of averages or on the behavior of the majority. The majority of mankind throughout all of human history has always turned away from God and failed him and will continue to do so. God's relationship with the entire human race is established and maintained on the basis of his relationship with the chosen few, with those few souls who truly give their hearts to him, in whom he can truly find delight. It is for the sake of these few that he pours out his mercy upon the rest. Just as it was in the days of Noah, in the days of Sodom and Gomorrah, in the days of Moses, so it was with the faithful remnant of the Jews at the time of Jesus, who turned to the Messiah with faith and love, and so it will be with a faithful remnant among the Jews as well as among the Gentiles at the time of the second coming. Now, I had promised to tell you the paragraph numbers from the Diary of St. Faustina, where Jesus says these incredibly encouraging words about the power and influence of a single pleasing soul's prayers. And they were paragraph 40, paragraph 198, paragraph 367, paragraph 431, paragraph 435, and paragraph 438. And I will now take a short break, as I often do, about halfway through the program. I will go on with the story of a single so-called faithful remnant, two Jewish twin brothers who converted to Christianity, to Catholicism, who both became priests and who had a tremendous influence on the relationship between the Catholic Church and the Jewish community, actually, which has endured from the time of their lives in the middle or late 19th century to the present day. So this is Roy Schoeman with Salvation is from the Jews on Radio Maria, and I'll be back in a few moments after this short musical break.
Come and follow me.
Hi, this is Roy Shoman. Welcome back to Salvation is from the Jews. Before the break, I was talking about the principle of the faithful remnant that in God's system of salvation, which of course began even before Judaism, continued through Judaism, and now continues through Christianity and the Catholic Church. And I'm very pleased to, I believe that we have a caller. So if we do, Michael, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. I have a call. My question is related to your book more than the specific topic of the faithful remnant. Do you want me to ask that now?
Sure. Sure.
Okay. The reason I called was I had some conversations with self-taught, like a Jew who became a Christian but considered the Messianic Jew tradition to be the one he was in. He's more of a Protestant, definitely. When I talked to him about the Eucharist, he found it repulsive. And I noticed some sources are attacking the Messianic Jews as promote. There's people on these TV channels promoting traditions like prayer shawls, and they're selling stuff, prayer shawls, and a whole bunch of products. And the attack was primarily how that these are Pharisaic, like traditions that don't have anything to do with faith or spirituality. And I wondered, have you heard of these attacks? Do you think there's any credence to that?
Thanks for the question. And if you stay on, I mean, in other words, I'm not asking you to get off the line. I just want to yes, I mean, my position is such that I hear all of both sides, arguments and polemics and so forth. And you raise kind of like you raise a couple of different things.
I didn't know how to be succinct with my question.
Currents that flow together in conflict. One is essentially this whole idea of Messianic Judaism, which is Jews who come to faith.
Hello?
The continuation of their Jewish identity. I just want to check if I'm still on the air.
Hello? I'm still on the air.
This was a funny noise on the line, but okay, great. So, for instance, there are Jews who come to faith in Christ, but they think they're still supposed to keep kosher. They think they're still supposed to observe the Jewish fasts and the Jewish holidays. They think they're still supposed to wear the ritual garments of Judaism and so forth. And that's because they are not Catholic, and they come to faith in Jesus, and they read the New Testament, and they kind of are pretending is too strong a word, but they're putting themselves in the situation of a Jew who comes to faith in Jesus, in the year 40 AD, when everything still had to be resolved and everything still had to be figured out about just how Jews who become followers of Jesus should be. We know all those answers because we have for one thing, we have the Catholic Church, which has resolved all those questions, because those were really burning questions in the first few decades of Christianity. The first crisis in the church, you can read about it in the book of Acts, was whether non-Jews who become followers of Jesus have to be circumcised, So there was this tremendous confusion. And you have that case of Peter thinking he still had to keep strictly kosher until that sheet was lowered right on the rooftop of, I think it was Joppa, and he was shown by God himself that he was to eat what had previously been unclean animals. So that confusion still exists today among Jews who try to kind of figure things out from ground zero on the basis of reading the New Testament and coming to faith in Jesus. And then on the other side of that equation, you have voices in the Christian world, and particularly in the Catholic world, who are infuriated by the idea that any Jews in the Catholic Church should continue any Jewish practices. So there can be a great deal of hostility towards, you know, the continuation of, you know, the use of, you know, talises, the Jewish prayer shawl, or the celebration of Passover Seders and so forth. When he was the prefect of the congregation, of the Apostolic Signatura, Cardinal Burke, Archbishop Cardinal Burke of St. Louis, when he was the highest authority in the legal system of the church, he gave a lengthy interview with the president of the Association of Hebrew Catholics precisely about how much was permissible in terms of Jews who enter the Catholic Church maintaining Jewish practices. And he said very unambiguously, and that interview is up on my website in video, it's up on the website of the Association of Hebrew Catholics, he said very unambiguously, as long as it's done in the light of Christ, in other words, you know, as long as the Jew who's a Catholic accepts fully who Christ is and all of the teachings of the Catholic Church, it's very easy to celebrate a Passover Seder in honor of Christ, because the Last Supper was a Passover Seder. It's like what Paul said in one of his letters, where he said, you know, if you fast, do so for the honor of God. If you feast, do so for the honor of God. What matters isn't so much what ritual practices you're following as much as the spirit in which you're following them. Does that kind of answer your question?
Yeah, that helps clarify it quite a bit. And
good.
I guess I was the natural follow-up is, how can I interact with the people I actually know? And some of these people, like obviously this man I talked about, he was a self-taught rabbi, formed his own little congregation, and you know, as far as I know, it's completely isolated, mm-hmm. and in its own little church, which, mm-hmm. you know, like this peripheral. And the Sola Scriptura, it's like making the same error. And you had addressed that earlier about how they're trying to refigure out first century mm-hmm. issues and questions
yeah.
without following the teaching of the church.
Yeah.
So the question I have is, when I interact or discuss such issues with them, what would you suggest?
Well, I'm not terribly sanguine about the outcome, and I've had interactions with people in his situation, and the problem is, in part, is that he would, I mean, I would like to be Pope too, in a sense. I mean, everybody would prefer, in a sense, to, you know, figure out everything for themselves and essentially be Pope and make all the rules and have other people as followers, than to be a follower and be obedient and submit to the authority of someone over them. And of course, he loses that. He loses all of that if your arguments are right. So, you know, it's an uphill battle. You certainly could mention, you know, my book Salvation is from the Jews to him.
I would definitely recommend it.
Yeah, but I haven't really, you know, made much headway, because the danger is that somebody in a position like that is quite invested in the conclusions they've come to, and it would be very costly on a personal basis to, you know, kind of allow yourself to see the truth lying somewhere else. You could, again, without being terribly sanguine about the outcome, I would suggest that you encourage him to become familiar with the writings of basically the apostolic fathers who learned Christianity from the apostles themselves. You have apostolic fathers who learned Christianity literally at the feet of John the Evangelist. It's very unlikely that they got it wrong. And they wrote extensively, and they described real Christianity, which is Catholicism. They described the real presence in the Eucharist at Mass. They described the primacy of the Bishop of Rome and so forth. And if he was willing to read the Apostolic Fathers, who actually, as I said, they're the first generation of Christians after the apostles. They overlapped with the apostles. They learned Christianity from the apostles. How on earth could he dispute their knowledge, since it came from the apostles themselves? There's a very good book called Four Witnesses by a man named Rod Bennett. I believe that's B-E-N-N-E-T-T. But in any case, the book is called Four Witnesses. It's the writings of four of the apostolic fathers who learned Christianity from the apostles. And it's just a selection of their writings, which basically confirm the teachings of the Catholic Church. So that's basically the best recommendation I can come up with.
Thank you. That's very helpful.
Great. So this is a wonderful luxury. I think we actually thank you very much for your call, Michael, and I think we have the pleasure of another caller. Terry, are you there?
Yes, sir. I'm right here.
Great.
Just to mention, we had a Seder supper several years ago here at our church at St. Peter's in New Iberia, and it was very informative. It was festive and educational. And especially the young people enjoyed it very much, and I wish we could do that every year. As an evening during Lent, and I think it was very, very informative. A gentleman who was a Jewish convert to Catholicism. What I'm asking you, I don't mean to do a commercial, but and you probably mentioned this before, but how do we get your book? Is it in paperback? And
great,
that is the details, because I may have missed that on previous programs.
Terry, I'm happy to answer your question. I'll answer it with two commercials. One is you mentioned the Passover Seder, which is so educational that you had at your parish, and that's in fact one of my favorite things to do, and I do a number of them. Particularly during Lent, where I go to different parishes or Catholic communities and lead what I call a Passover Seder in the light of Christ, where I go through the rubrics of the Passover Seder. I actually lead a Passover Seder according to the rules and kind of liturgy of the Passover Seder, but pointing out the fulfillment of the essentially the prophetic content and the Christological content of the Passover Seder in Christ and in the Passion of Christ and in the Catholic Mass. So I kind of weave together the typology of the Jewish Seder, the precursor event of the Exodus from Egypt and the Passover Lamb and the Passover Seder and the centrality of that in Judaism, with the fulfillment of that in Christ. And of course, we all know that the Last Supper was both a Passover Seder and the first Catholic Mass. And so it's very natural to see the Passover Seder, the Catholic Mass, and the Passion of Christ basically being, in some sense, three branches, somehow linked in a very profound trunk. And I try to do that. So if anyone is interested in that, you can get in touch with me through the website. First commercial. Second commercial is, yes, I have two books out. They're both out with Ignatius Press. They can be bought in virtually any bookstore. Ignatius Press is one of the largest Catholic publishers, if not the largest Catholic publisher in the country. The first one is Salvation is from the Jews, The Role of Judaism in Salvation History from Abraham to the Second Coming. And it's basically the theology that unites Judaism with Catholicism. It's what I spend most of my time on the show talking about. And you can get it from Amazon.com, frankly. You can get it from my website. If you go to my website, salvationisfromthejews.com, on the homepage, I have links how to order the books, and they'll connect you to Amazon.com to order the books from Amazon.com. And or you can get them from Ignatius.com or any Catholic bookstore, or even any Barnes & Noble or ordinary bookstore, although they might have to order them for you. The other book is called Honey from the Rock, 16 Jews Find the Sweetness of Christ, and it's a collection of 16 Jewish to Catholic witness testimonies, 16 Jews who entered the Catholic Church, telling their witness testimonies in their own words. And so basically, that's what I do on the show, right, is basically either one or the other book, either talk about the theology uniting Judaism with Catholicism, or talk about Jewish converts and their experiences, which is like honey from the rock. So anyway, anything else, Terry?
Well, the website is salvationisfromthejews.com.
Yes, all one word, Salvation is from the Jews.com, which, not coincidentally, is also the title of the first book.
Okay, and I just want to say that everything you talk about is very interesting and basic to the Catholic religion, and we really appreciate you. And
thank you.
Thank you for being on the air.
Nice to hear, because, you know, it's very, very encouraging. One of the reasons I wrote Salvation is from the Jews is, you know, as a Jew, when I entered the Catholic Church, like, my brain exploded, like, everything makes sense. This is the most natural thing in the world. You know, everything in the Catholic Church almost, you know, is shouting out its predecessor in Judaism. The connection is overwhelming. As I often say, I mean, it's impossible for me to see them as two separate religions. They're one religion divided into two phases. The first phase to prepare for the incarnation of God as man, and the second phase to spread the fruits of the incarnation throughout the whole world. Because of the nature of the task of the incarnation, that first phase had to be restricted to a single ethnic group, which was the Jews and Judaism. But the intention of that was always to enable the incarnation so that the fruits of the incarnation and passion and death, of course, could permeate all of mankind through the Catholic Church. It's just, I mean, it's one story, and one very compelling story, and an understanding of the Jewish side of the story confirms, I think, is very faith-strengthening for the Catholic side of the story, for Catholics, because, you know, the Catholic Church did not begin, I mean, okay, I don't want to be heretical on this surface, but you could think that the Catholic Church, the Catholic Church began on Pentecost Sunday, but the Catholic faith didn't begin on Pentecost Sunday. Catholicism began, you know, with Abraham, in a sense. You know, Judaism is pre-Messianic Catholicism, and Catholicism is post-Messianic Judaism. And this was so obvious to me that it just puzzled me that this wasn't the understanding or the viewpoint or the attitude of, you know, I don't want to say every Catholic, but, you know, that permeated the Catholic world. And so it was out of that I wrote Salvation is from the Jews. And I never expected many people to be interested in it, but it turned out that the year it was published, it became Ignatius Press's number two bestseller. So anyway,
congratulations. Of course, what you're saying is that everything was predicted and prophesied in the Old Testament, and you can just go back and see Jesus referring to the prophecies and how they were fulfilled in the Catholic Church.
Absolutely, and everything in the Old Testament, the meaning, the real inner meaning, the importance of it is, in some sense, only fully understood through the eyes of Christianity, through the perspective of Christianity, because much of the Old Testament was hints of what was to come, and it's only when you saw the fulfillment of those hints that you recognize the beauty and the power and the totality of those hints, or of those prefigurements or whatever, over and over and over again. It's one story. It's one very powerful story.
Well, we really appreciate you, and keep up the good work, and keep staying on the air.
Okay, thanks. Well, I will as long as I'm invited. So thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And thanks for calling in. And
have a good weekend.
You too. God bless. I will ask for prayers. I probably shouldn't do this. Maybe this is my third commercial, but I'm asking this week for prayers. My parents are 95 and 102. They're no longer young, and they have not reconciled with Christianity and with God, in fact. So if anybody wants to throw up an extra special prayer that my parents might sit right with God when the time comes, I would be extremely grateful. Let me kind of close the show. I mean, obviously, you know, we've come to the last few minutes of the show. I was going to continue in the book with the story of the Lehman Brothers. And so I will give that very quickly, I think, because I only have about 2 or 3 minutes. Maybe a later date I'll talk more about the Lehman Brothers. But the Lehman Brothers were two twin boys who lived in the middle of the 19th century. That's in, you know, around the 1840s. They were orphans. They became Catholics. They wanted to become Catholics when they were adolescents. They waited until they were adults legally, in other words, until they were 18 to be baptized. They were, when their family found out, because they were being raised by aunts and uncles as orphans, the family was so incensed that actually their uncles, I hate to say it, but tried to kill them. And they escaped, one of them escaped the clutches of one of the uncles, enough to run to the window and scream help. And there were some soldiers in the street who came in and then prevented the other uncle from strangling the other twin brother. Anyway, they became Catholics, and it became a scandal at the time. After they became Catholics, they eventually became priests and canons of the church and wrote about 150 books between them about the Catholic faith and were very active at the First Vatican Council. But what I want to do now is read you the letter they wrote to the editor of the local paper as they were basically right after the scandal broke. In other words, this letter was written by two 18-year-olds to defend their decision to become Catholic. And I think that by the time I finish reading this letter, it'll probably be the end of the time we have for today. So this is their letter to the editor of the local paper in Lyon, France, September 17th, 1854. "We see ourselves in the necessity of breaking a silence which we had determined to keep. The newspapers have spoken enough about the unfortunate incident which has brought us to the public's attention," that incident being when their uncles were trying to kill them and they were saved by the soldiers. "If we alone were being accused, the condemnation that was placed on our conversion would be of little concern to us. Our conscience belongs to us alone, and we recognize no one else's right to it. But as certain people are circulating malicious insinuations with respect to the clergy, it has become our duty to reveal the truth and enlighten the opinions of reasonable men. In our conversion, all has been the work of God. From our childhood, the sight of Catholic services greatly impressed us, to the point that we felt regret that we were not Christian. When we began school, this regret became more acute. We saw, on one hand, a few Jews, on the other hand, a great number of Christian children. This difference struck us. When they went to Mass and we heard the songs accompanied by the organ, we blushed to be reduced to gathering in an ordinary classroom and go through the motions of a pointless ritual. But what shook us even more were the love and the devotion of the priests and religious who vowed themselves to the service of the ill, a devotion which we compared with the coldness and indifference of the others who surrounded us. On top of that, one of us fell gravely ill. We were drawn more and more to Catholicism. However, we dared not broach the question. We wanted to study further. The further we advanced in our study, the more sharply we saw the false position we were in. We opened up history, and we could not avoid becoming aware of the present state of the Jewish people as compared to its past. More and more difficulties, which our rabbi never could resolve, piled up in our heads. The study of the classics of the Catholic Church were able to prepare our hearts to receive the grace of a God of mercy. Then we searched the Holy Scriptures. From the start, we understood we could not walk alone. We must find a holy priest. Every day from then on, he gave us instruction, dissipated our doubts, explained to us the prophecies, and enabled us to grasp the link between the old and the new law. Then we said to ourselves, if the Messiah has already come, it is Jesus Christ, and we must become Christians. If he has not yet come, we must nevertheless no longer remain Jews, because the time of the promise has passed and our books have lied. The priest made us wait over a year. After we graduated from high school, we insist on being baptized. He could not refuse our request. We became Christians and we became happy. No one can make us renounce our faith. We are resolved to die first. It seems to us that the age of 18 is old enough to discern the true from the false. Furthermore, the Jews have demanded freedom of religion for themselves and for Protestants. They can hardly refuse it to us." So ends the letter from the Lehman Brothers. It's probably a good place to end the show, especially since I'm out of time. So I want to thank you for listening. This has been Salvation is from the Jews on Radio Maria. This is Roy Shoman, and I hope you join us again next week. Bye for now.